Good evening, diners and drinkers and
what are you doing
travelers.
Here? What are you doing here?
I'm changing it up, just making sure you're paying attention.
Okay, well, I'm paying attention.
Hey, does everybody know that we're in our 13th year of doing this show?
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
It's an hour a week, every single week, for over 12 years.
And the funny part about it is, you know what, it never gets dull.
No, but I wonder how many hours it is, how many people we've had on. I guess when we're bored sometime we can try counting.
I don't know, Mike.
At any rate, the show is on the menu, and we're in Peter Haig, coming into your little world. And today we have three different concepts on the show. The first one, I mean, Steve Sando has grown and sells the most fascinating array of beans. We love them. He loves them. And I think you will love too. You know, Steve Sando, I've been after you for a long time for an interview. I happen to be, and so Peter, co-host Peter, is also, we're absolute bean lovers. I mean, we're passionate about beans.
Everyone's coming out of the woodwork. I'm loving this. So for years, I felt very lonely when I would do the farmer's markets. People would come by and think they were buying nuts and get all excited, and they go, ooh, they're beans. We're two bean freaks, as we call them, and everything, you realize, okay, we're on the right track. This is a good thing to do.
Now, when did you start this company, and what was your original intention?
Well, I was a frustrated home cook. I have no background in agriculture. I'm not particularly a good business person, until I found out. I just was a home cook, and I kept hearing about heirloom tomatoes in particular, and then heirloom beans were the next thing. And I lived in Europe for a while, and I've traveled a lot, and I'm kind of very aware of what it means to be an American. And I thought, this is our own culture, the food, and we don't even know what it is, because the beans are all indigenous to the Americas.
So this is really the main vein, the gold standard of bean production, the Americas.
Yes. Well, I'd say favas and garbanzos and lentils are from Europe and Asia, but most common beans, like everything from pinto to even Italian borlotti or French flageolet, all have roots in Mesoamerica, so central Mexico mostly.
The Italian does too, huh?
Yeah, no, and just like they took tomatoes, I think we wouldn't recognize a pre-Italian tomato necessarily. And they took the beans and then bred them. The Italians were master breeders, and they really changed these New World products to their specifications.
Yeah, we had beans from that that lake that specializes in those.
Lake Trasimeno is the one. I was thinking. I'm thinking of your store as like a storefront that we saw in a little town at the edge of Lake Trasimeno on the border of Umbria and Tuscany.
Oh, perfect.
Where they have beans of every shape, size, and color you can imagine, just like your catalog.
I love that. And the nice thing is, you know, they're bean people there, obviously, the Mangia Fagioli, and they understand cooking with simplicity. Like, one of the hardest parts of doing what we're doing, especially with heirloom beans, and it's really hard for people to believe that an heirloom is going to be that much different than a store-bought kidney bean, but it's just like with tomatoes, if not even more dramatic, I think. But when you have a really good heirloom bean, all you need is a little salt and maybe a drizzle of olive oil, and you're happy.
Oh,
whereas
yeah.
If you have a crummy commodity bean, you need to add a ham hock or a ton of chicken stock. And you really, I almost insist people cook these super simply the first time, and usually they convert.
Now, your business model is you're the distributor, retailer of beans that people grow for you. Is that the way it works?
Yes, we have a network of farmers. We give them the seed at the beginning of the season. They grow for us, and we buy everything back, less the seed, which they hopefully will keep for the next season. And we have probably 6 or 7 farmers in California, and we're working up to Oregon and Washington as well.
You mean that where people are growing for you?
Yes, and it's hard because most farmers don't want to grow heirlooms. They're really hard to grow on a commercial level.
Yeah.
So that's why they've been really thriving with home farmers or home gardeners. But on a commercial level, there's this macho thing where you have to get so many pounds per acre And I always say, you know, we pay you more per pound, so it balances out, but they really don't have that mentality. So it's really hard finding a guy who, or gal who wants to do this.
It's interesting. So in fact, one of the reasons that farmers grew away from heirloom beans was because it was easier for them to get a bigger crop. And the bigger crop was what they thought gave them a bigger bank balance, I guess.
Yes, and at one time, the canners were their biggest customers, so they really wanted uniformity and consistency, where I don't really care. In fact, I love the freaks of nature that come about. So it's a completely different goal. But the problem is, growing for commodity, you've got the Chinese and actually the Peruvians competing, so it's a race to the bottom. Like, how much more can we produce? And word flavor is really never discussed, what you lose in order to produce the
What is the bean in Peru? We've been in Peru. We've been around Peruvian food a lot. Which is the bean?
Well, no, Peruvians will grow everything and do it really, really cheaply.
Oh.
So, but there are actually, what's funny, is some incredibly good heirloom Peruvian beans, but they really aren't available commercially mostly.
Right. Well, of course, they have that Virgil Martinez as recording. I don't know what it's an archive of all their native products. Of course, the most of which is potatoes.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right.
But I'm sure that they're doing the beans too, because beans all of a sudden are having their big moment. I think, don't you think?
Yeah. To me, it's a nice non-political way of thinking of the Americas. This is what our food is, this is what we produce, and this is who we are. So I think knowing beans is really essential, especially if you have good ones. And I always say, my point of reference was canned red kidney beans at the salad bar at the pizzeria, I wouldn't like beans either. And I think, sadly, that's what most people think of with beans. So if you can get heirlooms, or just beans lovingly made, you really can change things. And it's a great form of protein. You know, the other thing I was going to say, sorry, I'm like a pinball machine up in my head. But we've never marketed them for health or the greenness of them, which are two real viable things. I mean, beans, people grow beans in the fields to fix the nitrogen. They're incredibly healthy between the proteins.
I have them every day, Peter, too.
Yeah.
And I told you, I shared the Blue Zone story with you a long time ago, they were interviewing, you know, the Blue Zones are those places across the globe where people regularly live past 100, and they interviewed this Sardinia is one of the Blue Zones, Sardinian guy, and said, what is the secret to your longevity? And he said, beans.
I love that.
Or whatever the Italian word for beans is. Fagioli.
What's that? Sorry?
I said, or whatever the Italian word for beans is, which is probably fagioli or something like that.
Fagioli, yeah. And I think it changes a little bit when you get down south. That's funny. No, and there's another one called the jungle effect, where they went to all the cultures that are the healthiest. And there were a couple of things in common, but one of them was fermented foods and the other was some kind of legume.
Yes, so, I like both of those things, fermented.
Yeah, no, exactly. But we've always marketed it as a fabulous, flavorful ingredient, because I do find people really, they are sort of interested, but they don't actually buy healthy food or moral food. They say they want to, but when you can say, no, these are absolutely delicious, oh, by the way, they're healthy and green.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we didn't invent heirloom beans by any stretch, but I think that's why we're the first company to really get traction with them.
Yeah, well, they did the study on the listing of the calories on menus does absolutely nothing to influence food choices.
No. And we have a lot of shrill, you know, eco-activists who come up and want to talk to us, but I've noticed they never buy anything. They just want to tell us how to do stuff. When I started at the farmer's market, I'm here in Napa, California, and I couldn't get in the local Napa one because I thought the beans were weird, believe it or not. So I had to go to the one up in Yountville, which is considered kind of crummy. But it was such a boon because Thomas Keller was one of the first chefs to come by. And once he did that, doors opened up.
Oh, that's great. Now, where do you get the beans from? Where do you get the seeds to start off with?
Well, as a home gardener, I would just go online. There's a great group called the Seed Savers Exchange.
Oh, yeah, and I know the Seed Savers.
Yeah, and once a year, they have a catalog, and you offer what you have, and they offer what they have. My idea of a really good time, though, is to go to Mexico and go into farmers markets, the tianguis, they call them, and find old indigenous women and see what they have. And I flip out. And the nice thing about beans is beans are seeds, so you can just bring some beans home and try it at home as well, which is where we got a lot of our stock.
And of course, you don't tell the customs service or anything like that.
No, beans you can bring in.
Oh, you can. Okay.
Yes, I've researched this, and I travel. I go about 5 or 6 times a year, so I can't afford to try and get away with anything.
Right. Okay.
But seeds, beans are okay. Seeds, and I think, don't tell anybody, but I think they don't understand that beans are seeds. Otherwise, they wouldn't be. But we started importing heirloom corn at one point, and they confiscated that.
Okay.
But chilies are okay. So if you bring dried chilies, dried corn, it's
not. So the key thing is that they're dried.
But corn was dried, too, and they wouldn't let me bring it in.
Well, there's competition factor in the industry, corn industry. So. Now, yeah. I mean, this off the top of your head, I mean, how many varieties of beans do you think there are?
There are hundreds. It's probably less than 1,000. But
I
think once told me there was 400 and something. Uh-huh. And they don't, they're not open, they don't cross easily. So it's not like chilies where if you do, you know, two rows of two different chilies, they're going to cross. Beans are pretty, they're self-pollinating, they're not going to be such a problem. But, people breed them for different things. I think the rattlesnake bean that was popular a few years ago was a combination of a pinto and maybe Anasazi, I think is what I heard.
Now, what do you think is the prettiest bean?
Well, there's one that I hate to talk about because we've had horrible crop failure, but it's called Good Mother Stollard, and it looks like someone just painted stars all over it. It's really beautiful.
Wow.
Yeah, I like those ones, the cranberry beans.
Yeah, cranberries are beautiful. There's another one called Christmas Lima that is, I joke and tell people that we have children in the back hand painting them. But they get a fair wage. So it's like.
But, you know, your business must be nerve-wracking because for years now I've gone on your website and you have all these requests for beans that you're out of.
We try and have everything fresh within a year. Well, the goal was 2 years, but we haven't been able to keep it in stock for two, so it's usually a year. And beans are a crop, so we just can't shake a tree and get more when we run out. So, you know, we try and plan for the year, but it'll take one write-up or, you know, some fad diet, like red beans this week are hot, then we run out of those. And we do our best, but it's really, really hard. And then we have crop failure sometime.
Uh-huh.
So it's hard.
Yeah, you know, you have other services. There's, of course, your catalog online, but you're really anxious, according to what it says on your site, to talk to people and to help them if they have questions or about cooking or serving or anything like that. You really are a people-oriented business.
Yes, I would say that's pretty. Yes, and I love talking about it. I think that's. You know, I keep waiting for someone to try and compete with us, and they don't. But I really do love beans, and I love getting people excited about them, and also that it's an ingredient that is our culture. So for me, it's really fun. And in fact, this weekend we have been really busy, but I really go help out and with the customer service requests and answer a lot of emails, and people are always quite surprised it's me. But I think it's a great way to keep a pulse on things, and some questions need some extra help.
Well, but you're a small company. I mean, how are you going to keep up? You just said now you're totally. There was an article in the New York Times.
Yes,
and it like really totally put you in the weeds, right?
Yes, and it was very depressing for a few minutes because I want to, you know, get people very excited, so I don't want to. And to buy food online is a little bit of a push for a lot of people. So I really want the experience to be as good as possible. So normally we can turn our order around in a day or two, and it's been a full week. It's over now, but it was pretty ugly. But, yeah, so it's very hard for us in that sense.
You must get a lot of questions on handling of beans because I love favas. Oh, and my wildest experience is with fresh chickpeas that my greengrocer started getting in. There is no way of preparing chickpeas from scratch that's easy.
Well, I would argue if you got fresh ones that weren't stored in the desert, they're probably okay. We literally put them in the crock pot in the morning and we're serving them as samples in our store by afternoon, and we don't soak them. We put maybe a bit of onion and maybe a splash of olive oil, and that's it. And they're always done. And I've heard, you know, putting baking soda and doing all this other stuff. When your beans are fresh, you And by fresh, I mean within 2 or 3 years, and not stored in a desert situation. So ours are grown in California. They really don't have the extremes of heat, and they cook really fast. So it's hard for me when I see people say put in baking soda, because that can taste soapy. I don't see it, but...
What Dan's talking about is the fresh ones, not the dried ones, but the fresh ones.
The fresh ones, you have to peel them.
You have an outer coating and an inner coating, and you have to get that inner coating off. And our best discovery for garbanzos was that Whole Food Market stocks them fresh frozen and peeled and fresh frozen.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
You pay a little more, but it's a lot less work. Now, I wanted to point out one more thing, and then we have to let you go to your important New York Times audience and all the other people who are looking for packages of beans. But this is not just a website where you pick your bean. This is a website where there's a rich trove of recipes for how to use these in interesting and satisfying dishes.
You mean our website?
Your website. Yes.
Oh, that's fair. Thank you. And we also have videos, too. I think if you're older, you have Depression era associations with beans. If you're of a certain age, it's a hippie thing. But the nice thing is these young kids have no baggage. So they are just, it's beans. And they're ready, but they don't know how to do it. And it's been really fun helping them cook beans. Because there's so many things that affect the final pot. You know, how hard is your water, what kind of pot you're using, how much air you have in it. So it's really hard to give exact amounts of water, time, salt, everything. So you actually have to learn how to cook a tiny bit. But it's really fun because it's really hard to screw up a pot of beans. You have to work really hard to do that. I think beans are a great way, and you really learn cooking and how you can control things, and also just sort of to give it up to the bean gods, and it usually works out.
I just have one final question, and I'm confused here. And this comes from cooking dried beans according to the method that's on the outside of the package.
Okay.
And they seem to be telling me that if I'm soaking overnight, which they say is better, and it's no trouble, all you have to do is think about it a little bit earlier in the day, or earlier than the day you want to cook them. If you soak them overnight, then usually the instructions say discard the soaking water and add fresh water and even rinse the beans. And you seem to be saying exactly the opposite. You seem to be saying some of the vitamins will have found their way into the soaking water, so why would you throw them down the drain? So what's the right answer?
Well, I think as long as you're cooking beans, I used to care deeply, and now I don't care anymore. I think you need to do what you feel is intuitive and right. I don't even soak them anymore. So I just start cooking, and I maybe have to add a half hour or 45 minutes to the cooking time. The Italians, I do believe, mostly do soak and then rinse. Other countries, you know, keep the water. But when you soak dark beans, you can see how the water gets dark. And that could be, it is. It's vitamins and minerals. It's something that probably should be in you instead of down the drain.
Well, no, it's interesting. The last time I did black beans, I just happened to notice, and they really don't transfer a lot of color. I mean, the water's a little bit stained, but not very.
Well, I think it depends on the variety, but there's invisible things you can't see. Harold McGee, who wrote on food and cooking.
Yeah, we know Harold.
He talks about this, and he says that payoff is, they say if you rinse them, you get rid of the things that are indigestible and cause gas. But he says it's not much of a deal because you're also getting rid of some, and it's so minimal the effect of that in his opinion, it's not really worth changing the water.
I'm going to change my practice and do it according to Steve, because Steve, you're certainly a god of beans as far as I can tell.
Oh, that's sweet, yeah.
And there's one more question.
I want to know who it is that gets hired to put one stone in every bag of black beans.
Well, I'll say 85 to 90% of the cleaning is done in the fields. Uh-huh. There's a machine that cleans them up, so it really is just inevitable you're going to get some organic debris. Ours are really clean, but I think it's almost a disservice because people don't check as thoroughly as they should. You should always check. Because they're, you know, when the beans are ready, they cut them off at the roots. and they wait in the fields and they dry there. And then this big Rube Goldberg type machine brings up the beans, shakes them like crazy, breaks the pods and puts them right back in the soil as green manure, and the beans go in another bin. But you can see, when you see these things, you see, oh, that's why there's so much dirt sometimes.
Yeah, well, I caught Ruth Reichel on this, by the way, her black bean recipe. I said, you left out the very important first step. Sort through for stones.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's there's nothing worse than making this loving pot and finding a piece of dirt or stones, yeah.
Well, Steve, I'm glad we finally caught up with you because you're a delight. And of course, we're bean lovers from the very first venture into any kind of bean. We're right there in line.
I love that. Thank you. No, it's been fun. And anytime, I love talking about this. Not where I'm shy. There's other subjects I shouldn't be open my mouth about, but this one I'm good with.
Well, thank you again, and continued success. Repeat the website just for everybody.
Sure, it's ranchogordo.com. And we have stores in San Francisco and in Napa as well if you need to go see us.
Great. Well, continued success, Steve.
Thanks so much. I'm flattered. It's been fun.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There's no way you can say this man's not an enthusiast about his product.
Right.
But I'm sure you learned a lot. We learned a lot from talking to Steve, and more beans in our diet is a good thing. We hope you'll think that too, and that...
We practically have them every day, don't we?
And Rancho Gordo is a great place because you'll never run out of variety. And we'll be dealing with another issue that's important in the future of food right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I don't know about you, but canned tuna has been a fact of my life for as long as I can remember. I eat it quite a lot. So when the first stories started coming out about the exorbitant amount of mercury in it, I thought, ooh, whoa. I sort of assumed there was somebody watching over and taking care of all that, and it turns out there really wasn't.
But there now is.
Now we have Sean Wittenberg's company, Safe Catch, which does continuous mercury monitoring, let him tell you all about it.
Because it's quite an amazing story. It's encouraging to know that future generations, and some current generation, but the future generations of Americans will not just associate tuna with Charlie. Because there's a new kid in town, a company called Safe Catch, and we have their spokesman, Sean.
Co-founder, Sean.
Sean on the program with us right now.
Who started this company with his long-term friend.
You said I could start this interview off.
And then, Go ahead.
All of a sudden, she's jumping all over me, Sean. I can't get a word in edgeways. I didn't realize that so much of the tuna that we consume comes from not too far away from where you grew up in Marin County, California. And you love tuna. So take us the rest of the way. How did this translate into a company called Safe Catch?
Well, yeah, it really started as an idea that came from an article in a prevention magazine in the early 2000s, in the beginning of like 2003-04, where my mom brought an article talking about how pregnant women and kids can't eat seafood anymore because there's too much of a risk of mercury in the fish. And when we grew up eating a lot of seafood. Seafood was a big part of our diet. We ate canned tuna on a regular basis, loved it, and all of a sudden now as I'm leaving the university and this opportunity to try to solve a problem and try to make seafood readily available and bring people back to the category and give them confidence. It was a ways back, but what happened was we then realized to do that we had to figure out a way to quickly and accurately test fish for mercury to provide these standards. So it took us a long time to develop this technology and tool. PhD physicists participated in engineering labs, and a bunch of smart folks all got together, and we started to really work on this issue, and it became a process that we then carried ourselves forward to today, where we've now in our third iteration of this technology, we now have a tool that we've developed that can quickly and accurately test seafood for mercury, and using this technology, we set out to provide a product, which is SafeCatch, and this product is designed and built to protect really moms and kids from potential exposure to high levels of mercury.
And now, so quick question, Sean, just before I take you back to telling us exactly how it works, because exactly how it works in your system is really rather fascinating. But what you're saying, without saying it really out loud, is that there was no real significant amount of testing of the amount of mercury in fish that used to happen until you guys came along.
That's correct. Peter, that is absolutely correct.
It's kind of frightening.
There's no other brand in the market, and no other company in the market that provides anywhere near the type of testing that we provide. Some companies may test a batch of tuna every now and again, or a catch using a lab that can cost a significant amount of money to provide those tests to give them some insight into their product, but no one's providing proactive testing where they test every single fish in advance like we do. And when we first started testing, we realized that we had to test every fish, because when we would go through and begin testing schools of fish, we would see that there's high levels of variance in the mercury levels from fish to fish.
Isn't that funny? You would think they would all have been sort of doing whatever they do to survive in the ocean,
together, yeah.
all in the same place, and when the captains catch them, they're being caught shoaling rather than one fish at a time, so they're sort of all together. But tell us a little bit more now, like as you did just before we came on the air. How does all that work? First of all, the captains you're dealing with, they're off the coast of California.
They're all over the Pacific Ocean.
Okay,
the product, the tuna that's caught that's used for canning is caught and frozen at sea, either frozen using a blast freezer or a brine freezing technique. And it's frozen at sea so that they can be out at sea for months at a time and bring in a significant volume of tuna enough for canning. So the product is caught at sea and then brought in, and we set up a system where we test fish and guarantee to purchase the fish from the captains who bring tuna to shore if it meets our complete criteria or standards. And our standards are really broken down into three elements. Our first element is conventional quality. The fish has to be of the highest quality for us to take it. It has to. We look at things like smell and firmness and fat content, eye quality and clarity, gill quality and clarity, all the signs that that traditional seafood companies look for to ensure that those products are of the highest quality. So that's criteria number one. Criteria number two is sustainability. We're partners with the Monterey Bay Aquarium and their Seafood Watch program. So we will only buy fish that meet either Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch yellow or green rank, which means it's a good alternative or best choice by the aquarium, which is our commitment to sustainability. And then lastly, if it meets those first two criteria, then we test that fish for its mercury concentration. Each fish, one by one.
It seems like almost impossible to do.
It's not impossible to do. It's just very, very difficult. And like most things that matter, they can be challenging somewhat and daunting to look at those tasks and those needs. But what we've come to learn is when a group of smart, well-intended people come together and set their mind to a problem, you know, they can find great solutions. And we've been blessed in our company to have a great team that's smart and passionate and driven like we are, myself and my co-founding partner, Brian Boucher, who we talk about on the website, who are like-minded like us in wanting to really help people and to really be a part of providing healthy food solutions for moms and kids and health-conscious consumers.
Well, the good news is that there actually are fish out there that are not as contaminated as what we read about in the papers.
Oh, certainly, certainly. What we found, as I maybe mentioned to you before we got on this interview, is that there's still plenty of pure fish in the sea. The issue that we see is in large part because of industrial pollution and man-made sources of contributing more mercury into our environment. What we've seen is that the variance of these mercury levels between fish is extremely high. So that, you know, we've seen it to the extent where two fish that are the same size from the same school can vary in mercury concentrations by up to 20 to 25 times. And that is the reality of what we face today. So because of that variance, we developed a tool to identify those fish from within the school that would be a great choice for moms, for kids, for health-conscious consumers who want to eat seafood regularly. We can go out, we can test, we can find those fish, and we can identify them for safe catch.
Now, you only do tuna.
Today we have begun our product launch with three different options. We have an albacore. We have an albacore with no salt added, so low-sodium albacore. And then we also have Safe Catch Elite. And Safe Catch Elite, we use the skipjack tuna. In that product, Safe Catch Elite is the lowest mercury tuna of any brand in the market. The Safe Catch Elite is the one that we recommend for the most, what we could say, sensitive or vulnerable consumers, like a pregnant woman or a small child or someone who eats seafood often, many times a week. We really point them towards our Safe Catch Elite. It's my favorite. It's the one I eat the most. I probably have four or five cans of Safe Catch Elite a week. I love it.
Now, the standard that you're operating by is, I think you said, 10 times more discriminating than the... Who is it, the fisheries?
The FDA.
The FDA, okay.
Yeah, so what we did for the Safe Catch Elite, our standard is 10 times stricter than the FDA's. The Safe Catch Elite, what we did in developing the standards for that is we went out and we looked at the recommendations made by dietitians, nutritionists, and the accredited bodies who are out there giving the advice on how to eat seafood safely and how to do so responsibly. And what we did is we aligned our standards with those groups. And, you know, what we've been able to do now with the Safe Catch Elite is we've been able to develop the first tuna product that meets Consumer Reports, U.S. Consumer Reports, low mercury criteria, which are the standards they set for vulnerable groups like pregnant women and small children. And that's really what makes us so excited is we have the science and the process and the expertise to provide products that are, you know, our health professionals recommend we enjoy. So, I mean, when you look at Safe Catch Elite, you have a product now, I mean, in our can, which has 35 grams of lean protein in a Safe Catch Elite can. It has no sugar, no carbs, has 140 calories, and it has, you know, mercury levels as low as a sardine or as low as a wild salmon. It's really exciting to now be able to provide that and feel good about it. And that's what drives our company is we think about the people that we're helping and we try to help them every day.
Now, the couple of things we should emphasize before we close, because
I wanted to ask a question.
Oh, go ahead, Lois.
What is this complicated, labor-intensive, time-consuming process due to the cost of a can of tuna?
Well, I was going to come around to that one.
Yeah, so from a cost perspective, we're able to do this at a very, very low cost relative to the other technologies. So existing technologies in the market cost between $80 and $100 to perform a test, and when it requires a sophisticated operator, and it requires time. It requires days, sometimes as much as a week, to get results back. So when you see those problems, we realized that we needed to come up with a solution that would be a real-time test that could happen in the seafood supply chain environment, in the processing environment, and it could be pennies on the dollar. So we were able to do all those things. So we're able to provide a product that is competitively priced with other brands on the market, and we were able to do that effectively. So we don't talk about the specifics of our testing costs, but we're able to do so in a way that makes our retail competitive with the other brands in the market.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that point. The good news on which to close out the interview is first of all, it's readily available. I double checked.
How do you get it?
It's through distribution. Giant Eagle has it in all their stores.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Giant Eagle has it, and they're very forward thinking, and really were one of the early adopters of this. Really cutting edge company to really think about the health and wellness of their customers. So we were a great fit for Giant Eagle, and we were thrilled that they would consider carrying us in their stores. If there's not a Giant Eagle around, if you go to our website, which is www.safecatch.com, we have a store finder, and we're also available to be ordered online, either through our website or through Amazon.
Sure. I did exactly that, Sean. I did a search on our home zip code, and we're in Giant Eagle territory. It's nice to know that you're on the shelf next to Charlie the boom 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 tuna.
That's right.
The other thing we must say we forgot all about this. Well, we didn't really forget all about this. It really tastes good.
We forgot
about that bit.
Well, it's pure. They don't put any junk in the
exactly.
Yeah, it's pure, and we also do it all by hand. So, unlike other tuna companies, we hand cut and hand pack sushi grade tuna steaks into our BPA free can. And unlike other brands, instead of using additives, we cook our fish in its own natural fat,
yeah.
And it yields a much cleaner, richer flavor, and it also retains all the available nutrients that are in that fish, unlike other brands that do pre-cooking and add additives. So all the available nutrients and all the available omega-3s and amino acids, selenium, everything is that the fish naturally provides, that nutritional powerhouse, is all captured in the can. So we encourage everyone to go out and try it. You know, you're putting really one of the healthiest foods of any food you can put in your body is our Safe Catch Elite. And
well, you're a superhero, I think, Sean.
Thank you. You're an inspiration. You really are. The cannery business collapsed in the United States decades ago, and here you are bringing it back with a wonderful new version. Suitable for today's environment and today's dietary choices. So we congratulate you on doing that. We wish you and your partner very well, and I'm sure you'll come back and talk to us again.
We'd love the opportunity to talk to you whenever we can, Peter. We really appreciate you and Ann and giving us an opportunity to talk about our product. We're still just a little guy out there trying to make a difference, and we need the help of people like yourself to help us get the word out and realize that companies like us, people like us, are out there trying to do these things, but we can't do it without you. So thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Sean. Good meeting you.
You as well. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.
It's really an amazing story, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And I think sometimes, you know, we don't sell our country as much as we should, but I have a feeling that there's something about this story that could only happen in America. And I think we're very proud of what Sean and his partner are doing, and we hope that you'll follow their Safe Catch product and enjoy. And now it's time to take a break, and then we'll be back for the final segment of the program.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are for our final segment, and we're going to be talking to Dana Gunders. And Dana Gunders is, well, she has a complicated job title, but what we're going to be talking to her about is the Waste-Free Kitchen. It's a manual she produced to help cut down on food waste. The numbers are absolutely astounding. That I've heard some of the numbers say that 20% of all food purchased in a supermarket or grocery store gets tossed. And considering all the people in the world starving, and even in our own country, we have to do something about it. Let's listen to Dana and some of her easy tips for starting down the Dana, you're full of new information here that I didn't even know anything about. I didn't even know there was a degree called Earth Systems, but you have a BS and an MS in that from Stanford, so it must be a pretty good degree.
It is a good degree. It's a combination of earth sciences and economics and some policy. So it's trying to really bridge the connection between sort of scientists and the way the political world actually works.
Well, your book is called Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. It's a subject that's everywhere these days. And I mean, I got to really see how serious it was when the guy who founded Trader Joe's has built a whole business model on rescuing food that would otherwise have expired according to the date, and he's having a low-cost supermarket chain built. Do you know about that?
I do, yeah, and I agree. I think it's a testament to just how much good food is winding up going to waste out there. Perfectly good, edible, nutritious food is still getting thrown out all over the place.
Well, but how risky is what he's doing? I mean, if it says that it's expired, how do you know how long to keep it?
Well, and the thing about expiration dates is that they are really not, you know, an indication of a food's safety or when it's bad. They're really an indication of when the food is at its best quality, and they're just a manufacturer's best guess. They're not regulated. So oftentimes those dates just mean, oh, 8 out of 10 consumers that were in a focus group rated the product a 6 instead of a 7, and all of a sudden that's when the date clicks in. It's not that it's bad or going to make you sick.
Now, how did you decide to become an expert in this whole field? Because you certainly are, and perhaps you can explain the organization you work for just a little bit, as well as this book that we've been fascinatedly reading.
Sure, happy to. I work for an organization called the Natural Resources Defense Council, often called NRDC, and we are an environmental nonprofit similar to Sierra Club or Environmental Defense or WWF, one of the groups that's been around for, we've been around for about 45 years, and we work on air pollution, water pollution, energy issues, and then we also have a group that works on food and agriculture. And I work in that group, and as part of my work on agriculture, I started stumbling upon these numbers that 40% of food was going to waste.
It's and horrific, I thought, isn't it? I mean, it really is horrific.
It is, and I just thought, you know, it can't be true, because if it were true, we would all know about it, and you know. And at the time, it really wasn't part of the conversation. And so I started researching it more and more. And what's horrific along with it is how many resources go into growing food in this country. We invest 70% of our water, half of our land, about 10% of our energy all go into agriculture, and yet we're not eating 40% of that. So it felt like a huge waste of resources, and that's really what got me into the topic.
Now, it seems, Dana, like this is something that the Department of Agriculture ought to have been worrying about for years.
I agree. I can't really explain why it hasn't been. It's just something, you know, I think everyone kind of knows that wasting food is not a good thing, and yet no one really had a sense of how much of it was going on. And because of that, it flew under the radar for quite some time.
Well, you know, your book is, in all measure, good measure, a handbook, truly, on how you can have your personal little input into changing the situation. And could you explain about what you delve into and how you organize your book?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we as consumers, the general public, contribute a big portion of how much of the food is going to waste. So the book is really meant to give us a lot of tips and tools and tricks and strategies to waste less food. And it is meant to be a reference book that you can have in your kitchen, even though it is quite lighthearted and fun at the same time. So it starts off by talking about shopping, actually. And really, when you're at the store, that's when you commit to food. And so there's strategies in there to really just not buy more than you actually wind up eating. I think when we're in the store, we are not all that realistic about the week ahead and how much time we're going to have to cook and what we're going to feel like eating. And so I try to give people some tools to really help be more realistic about that, plan their meals better, use a shopping list. But even some little tricks like when you're standing in the checkout counter, taking a look back in your cart and trying to identify a time during the week when you're actually going to eat each food that you're about to buy. Because if you can't think of when you're going to eat it, you probably don't need to buy it that week.
Now, the amazing thing is it would be altogether too easy for you to just have a soapbox. Stand on the soapbox and cry, don't do this, don't waste food, don't do this, don't do the other thing. But you're very practical in ways that are quite remarkable. So perhaps, I mean, I can give our listeners a clue by saying you have a wonderful section on where should you put things in your refrigerator to presumably maximize their refrigeration life cycle. And in another place, you have a list of recommendations as to what needs to be refrigerated at all, meaning that, in fact, if you don't have to refrigerate it, then you presumably save power.
That's right. What I realize is that nobody wants to waste food, and yet we are doing it anyways. And so the information in the book really came out of me going on my own journey and trying to waste less food, which, by the way, is still a journey, you know? And so I realized I don't actually know what the drawers in the refrigerator are for or how I'm supposed to use them. And so I looked into those crisper drawers, and in the book we have a diagram that really tries to demystify how to use your refrigerator properly. And those drawers actually they create a different humidity zone. And so that allows your vegetables to stay a little bit crisper if you set it on high, or, you know, close it all the way, or set it to vegetables if it has that kind of lever. And then if you set your other drawer to low, you can put fruits in there, like apples and pears after they're ripe, things like that, that need a little bit more aeration but can still use the humidity.
Now, what are some of the things that people refrigerate that they don't even need to?
Well, one good example are tomatoes. I think a lot of people put tomatoes in the refrigerator when, in fact, putting a tomato in the refrigerator makes it mealy. It gives it that mealy quality. So you're best off leaving a tomato on your counter if you're going to use it within the next, you know, few days. If you're not going to get to it, or a few days have passed and you still haven't used it, then you can put it in the refrigerator, but then you're better off cooking with it to get rid of that mealiness.
Now, we've found something very interesting. This is Anne's own invention, that you could actually just go ahead and freeze them. If there was a good deal on tomatoes, or it was tomato season and you had lots and lots of growing in your yard, then you just freeze them until you need them in the middle of winter.
Yeah, whole. I mean, you don't have to. My mother used to can and, you know, make soft and do all that stuff. But I just didn't have time. It was at a crisis point, and I just washed them, dried them, and put them in the freezer bag and stuck them in the fridge. I mean, in the freezer. I'm sorry, in the freezer. And then when you want them, dunk them in hot water so you could skin them, and you use them.
It's really quite amazing. We used some of 2014's tomatoes, I think just a few months ago.
And they still tasted fine.
And they still taste, yeah, they taste absolutely fine. The only thing you have to remember is the skins taste bitter, so the skins have to come off.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great trick. And I think, you know, freezing things in general is such an easy way to help you, you know, use them, make sure they get used eventually and when you're overwhelmed by whatever's in your current refrigerator stock. So that's great. And actually in the book we have a whole section on freezing and recommendations on how to, you know, how to stack things better, but also how to make them have the best quality when they're in the freezer. So some vegetables stay a little bit better if you blanch them first, and we have a chart on how you do that.
Right.
But other things, I mean, you can just pop almost anything in the freezer and it will last. I like to tell people to, if you're going away for the weekend or a week, if you put your milk in the freezer, that'll help it last. And when you come home, just put it back in the fridge, let it defrost, and you'll have milk for your coffee without having to go to the store.
Now here's a controversial one, eggs. Now, all my relatives in England, where admittedly the weather isn't quite as warm, they never refrigerate their eggs.
No, they're just sitting there.
And yet we do.
Right.
Why do you come down on that one?
No, that's true, but in Europe, eggs actually are vaccinated for salmonella before they hatch, and they don't do that here. So that's part of the reason that we refrigerate.
The other thing I read, actually, is that in Europe and other countries, they don't wash the eggs. And here in the U.S., they do, and that removes the protective coating on the egg itself.
That could be part of it, too, yeah. The thing about eggs, though, is that they last much longer than people think. So you can eat eggs 3 to 5 weeks after the sell-by date that you see on the eggs. And if you're not sure if you can still eat them, if you put them in a bowl of water and let them either float or sink, those that sink are still good to eat, and those that float are not.
It's funny. Avocados are the exact opposite.
Yeah,
if they float, they're good.
If they're ripe, they float. If they're truly ripe, they float.
I hadn't heard that. Good to know.
No, hold on a minute. We have to be careful with that one because my cousin Richard, who farms avocados in Tasmania, said that was his secret.
Yeah, that's right.
I let his secret out, so I guess it's okay for you to share.
I love it. Well, I'm going to borrow his secret and tell the world. Is that okay?
Well, let's do this. Let's make sure you attribute it to Dr. Richard Shaw of Sprayton, Sprayton, in Tasmania.
Okay, got it.
And,
writing it down right now.
Then he'll think it's okay. This is how he supplies restaurants all over Tasmania with avocados. He sells them wholesale for $3 a piece.
Mm.
But they're truly naturally matured and then naturally ripened, which, of course, is not what happens to an avocado here in the United States.
But, you know, right. Back to this book, I mean, one of the things that struck me, you know, is it comes up constantly, is what is the right amount? And you have a two-prong attack on this. The one is because recommended portions of food are so much higher. They're sometimes triple what it used to be as late as the 70s. And that, of course, triples the calories. And then you had a cute turn of phrase about, do you want a waste or a waste or something like that? But, and then the other one is people throw out a lot of food because they can't judge the amount. And see, this is, again, part of this thing where tradition passed along would tell you this, but it's changing, and it's not passed along one generation to the next anymore either.
That's absolutely right. Well, all of that is right. You know, our portion sizes have grown tremendously over the last 40 years. We, as you said, tripled. Actually, the average cookie has quadrupled in calories since the 1980s. It's amazing.
Oh,
and yet I get it because I remember doing bake sales when I was a kid, and I remember the size of cookies back then. And then now you walk into a coffee shop, and they really are almost four times as big. And yes, as I like to say, there's only two things happening to those extra calories. Either we're wasting them,
or we're going to,
or we're eating them, and then they're going to a different waste, right?
Now, I thought it odd that you devoted space in your book on the do's and don'ts for feeding scraps to chickens.
Well, you know, the book really just tries to get people to think about food as a resource and really try to stop and think, well, how could I use this before I throw it away? And if I'm not myself going to eat it, is there someone else to eat it? And if someone else is not going to eat it, can I give it to animals before I just throw it in the garbage? So, yes, we have some charts in there on what you can and can't feed to your dog and cat, and then another on what you can and can't feed to your chickens. And anyone out there who actually has chickens knows that it's an amazing use of vegetable scraps because they eat almost all of them, and then you get fresh eggs that you don't have to refrigerate.
Now, I thought one of the most interesting things, and it took away my guilt, is that you say that it's if you can't compost it and you can't give it to your pets or your chickens, the next best thing to do is to actually put it down the grinder garbage disposal, because it will finish up at the far end of the sewage food chain and might get reused there. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Unless there's sort of a big drought and or your local water utility can't handle it, then certainly putting food scraps down into the garbage disposal is a better use than throwing it into the garbage. You know, once food scraps have a lot of nutrients in them still, and that's why composting is so great, because it can capture those nutrients and, you know, get them back to your garden or other soil. You know, once it goes into a landfill, you can't, they're gone. We really can't recapture them. And furthermore, when food scraps go into landfills, when they rot there, they produce a gas called methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. So that's not good either. And those, when it goes through the water system, they do often find ways to reuse the materials.
Well, I think this is a very useful book. And I mean, as you say, you were a warrior in this, and you still have a long way to go to perfection, as we all do. But this is a great start. It's Dana Gunder's Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, a guide to eating well and saving money by wasting less food. And I mean, I think it's easy to read, and there are nice small steps too for doing this.
And if you want to know more, you can go to wastefreekitchen.com. Dana, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today, and we hope that the rain in California is doing good there, even though there seems to be altogether too much of it coming at once.
Well, we're appreciating it, and thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Dana. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And we'll be here, same time, same place, next week. We hope to join us then. And in the meantime, have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.